Thank you for joining us for Life and Taxes with tax attorney Andrew Foster of Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. Call in now with your tax questions at 800-818-2255 or locally at 247-7282 or 353-4674.
And Andrew's back with us, fresh off the holiday. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Good morning, Ben.
Good to have you with us.
Definitely.
Did you play any golf yesterday? I was just wondering in that heat.
Did get out there for nine holes in the day yesterday.
Yeah. All right, good. All right, so tell us, what do we have today?
Well, Ben, the Supreme Court's been busy releasing decisions. You know, we went through the Wayfair versus South Dakota sales tax case last week. Mm-hmm. And this week, I have a case for you, and it actually deals with probate law in the Supreme Court.
All right, so we got our music ready for the case now.
That's right.
So what do we have?
So, Ben, we'll allow you to wield the gavel of justice this time. And this time you got to really put the big robe on, because we're going to ask you to sit with the other eight justices and decide what you would do with regards to this case.
All right.
And, you know, it really deals with, to kind of preface things, divorce and beneficiary designations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is very interesting. I think this is one of those topics that is going to continue to come up. And now the Supreme Court has given us clarity, and we'll go through what the law is currently in North Carolina and what the law could be based upon this decision, that just came out of the Supreme Court. So again, the great thing about these cases are simple facts.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Mark and Kay, who were married in 1997. And Mark actually purchased a life insurance policy that year, mm-hmm. and he named Kay as the beneficiary for the policy and named his children from a previous marriage as the contingent beneficiaries.
Okay.
So what that means, Ben, is that if Mark dies, Kay will take the proceeds from the policy. In the event Kay predeceases Mark, then the contingent beneficiaries, Mark's children, mm-hmm. would be the ones that would take the proceeds from the policy.
Okay.
In 2007, unfortunately, Mark and Kay got divorced.
Right.
Okay. And when they got divorced, Mark never changed the beneficiary designation on mm-hmm. the policy.
Right.
And of course, what happens? He dies in 2011, and the life insurance company says, well, wait a second here. Mark has designated Kay, never changes policy, mm-hmm. Kay, to be the recipient of these life insurance proceeds. But Minnesota passed a statute that says that we're going to, you know, basically write out an ex-spouse who's designated as a beneficiary, and they passed that in 2002.
Oh, okay.
So
that was in effect.
That was in effect at the time that Mark did pass, but that when he initially got the policy, it wasn't in effect.
Right, right.
And so the ultimate question becomes whether or not, and life insurance policies, as you may know, Ben, are governed under contract law,
mm-hmm.
whether or not
the contract is retroactive.
That's right. Whether or not the law can be applied retroactively, and whether or not Kay gets the life insurance proceeds, or does the estate of Mark get the life insurance proceeds, or do we read it out and say the contingent beneficiaries get the proceeds? So mm-hmm. it's complicated in that sense. And the Eighth Circuit basically says, we believe that the contract clause in the Constitution, which is important, free contracts, should bar the retroactive application of the statute, and that Kay should get the proceeds from the policy. Mm-hmm. What that basically means in a lot of words there to say Kay gets the benefits because the contract was in 1997, and we don't believe the statute that was passed in 2002 will be applicable to a contract in 1997.
Did the statute itself mention retroactive application?
It was unclear from the facts and circumstances of the case, but my guess is that, you know, that's the way that they were going to read this, is that going forward, if someone dies after 2002, mm-hmm. You know, the statute's in effect, and that's the way that the decision should come down.
Okay.
So what do you think, Ben? So we got the Eighth Circuit saying Kay gets the proceeds from the policy. What do you think the Supreme Court says?
You know, it's interesting. Usually I follow the Supreme Court cases, but I haven't. I didn't see that one. That one, at least, I did not follow. So I don't know how they decided on that one. I'm going to say that they probably sided with the Circuit Court's decision on that. I was wrong.
So in an 8-1 decision, the Supreme Court, 8-1, written by Justice Kagan, mm-hmm. Gorsuch, the mm-hmm. lone dissenter on mm-hmm. this one, they believed that the application, the retroactive application of the statute, was the correct way to decide this. And they just said, you know, we agree that the freedom to contract is, you know, extremely vital mm-hmm. to the American system of governance. You know, however, we look and see whether there was a substantial impairment to the contractual relationship. And basically they went through and did an analysis and just said, is there a substantial impairment? Well, the fact that he likely would not want his ex-spouse mm-hmm. to get the proceeds from his life insurance policy, you know, is one factor at play. The law's likely, not likely to thwart the policyholder's expectations. You know, you're not reasonably going to expect that a beneficiary designation would hold firm after divorce. A lot of people are, that's a misconception. They think that if they get divorced, it automatically, you know, removes the spouse's name. That just isn't the case.
No.
And then basically the law is a mere default rule is what the Supreme Court said mm-hmm. and said, look, he had the power to change a beneficiary designation very easily through the use of just, you know, a form.
Yeah.
So it's very simple, minimal paperwork, you know, nothing really impairing him. So they said 8-1, that the proceeds from the policy would go to the children, because we're going to read K as being predeceased Mark in this mm-hmm. particular case.
Hmm.
So interesting decision there, especially because we don't typically get probate decisions that make it all the way up to the Supreme Court because they're state law matters. And, you know, it's rare that you can get a constitutional issue mm-hmm. of extreme importance where the Supreme Court wants to weigh in on it. But obviously they wanted to take a look at the Eighth Circuit's decision, and they made the decision that, you know, this Minnesota law is going to be the law.
I would guess that they're part of their decision, and you maybe have read it, but a part of their decision is that you look at the harm that would be caused by not allowing those who were retroactive to this law that would be caused by that.
Yeah.
So that would be part of it. But the other part is that if you're deciding these things outside of probate, you've got to be heads up about that.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I think that, you know, that's where I said
in North Carolina, we wouldn't follow that. Right?
That's exactly right. So North Carolina does not have the statute that mm-hmm. Minnesota has. So, you know, we do have a statute that says we're going to deem a divorced spouse as predeceased for terms of the will.
Right.
But the will would not govern. Mm-hmm. You know, beneficiary designations. Beneficiary designations trump what your will says.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people think, hey, I went there and changed my will, all good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just simply not the case, Ben, because in North Carolina, if we had this same situation, we wouldn't be in the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
and those proceeds would be paid out to Kay, and that would be the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sure, the children could file an action. But there's only been one case in North Carolina to date that have trumped a beneficiary designation.
Mm-hmm.
It was just some odd facts and circumstances where there was a separation agreement that said, separation agreement that was put into a divorce decree that said, you know, no life insurance proceeds to the spouse.
That's what I was going to ask you. If you included it in a separation agreement, could that blanket other beneficiaries?
It can, but the problem is that from the cases that, you know, like I said, they all tend to go with the ex-spouse's side.
Mm-hmm.
The language has to be so specific
mm-hmm.
that the court has to say unequivocally that the person did not intend for the ex-spouse to get these proceeds, and it just doesn't happen.
And the ex-spouse understood.
That's right.
Because it was part of the agreement.
Okay. Exactly.
Let's go to Jim in Newport now, find out what he has to say. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well, Bill.
Okay. What's your question?
Yeah. So, didn't the constitutional prohibition against the impairment of contracts play a role in that case?
You're right. Yeah. So the court, you know, recognized that the freedom to contract is extremely important. And that there has to be, as long as there's not a substantial impairment, and like I said, I went through kind of the factors and their analysis and reasoning, but they just basically determined that there was no substantial impairment. And so therefore they were going to allow the statute to be governing over the designation that was granted prior to the statute being in place.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a ex post facto law?
I could call it that. I mean, it's, you know, this is where we get into the weeds, and that's why we end up in the Supreme Court with this type of case, because you're right. I mean, it looks like, hey, look, this contract was done in 97. laws passed in 2002. How in the world can it be applicable? And the Supreme Court basically came down on the side that it did not. You know, Kay would sit there and say, "Hey, it impaired me. It impaired my rights."
Right, right.
But they said it did not.
Yeah, and also I would say, you, without having some explicit understanding, that Mark would not want that to go to his ex-wife. Yeah. I mean, they're making an assumption there.
The interesting thing there is that the word they used is likely.
Which I would imagine Gorsuch is the one that why he would object to that.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, obviously Gorsuch, you know, took the view that, hey, look, contracts are sacred. Mm-hmm. And this contract was made prior to this law being imposed. Now, the other argument, the flip side is, hey, look, laws change, and this law did change. And, you know, once you get divorced, you should have been aware and should have known.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is a tough one. This is a tough case.
Yeah, but it was 8-1.
Well,
8-1.
Yeah, look, I guess I'm off Trump's short list then.
Thanks, Jim.
All right. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just, you know, some highlights for North Carolina listeners, you know, for this is that, you know, right now as it sits, and always, whenever there's a divorce, you know, look at your estate planning documents.
Yeah.
Look at your estate planning documents and let's see. And it's estate planning documents. We don't call it a will, Ben, because that's just one component.
Right.
Because the will is, you know, controls probate assets, but these non-probate assets with beneficiary designations are extremely vital to one's estate plan. I mean, life insurance proceeds are always one of the biggest parts of an estate.
401ks.
401ks. You know,
pensions.
Pensions, payable on death accounts, transfer on death accounts that you set up beneficiaries on. All of this, if you had that ex-spouse named, would go to the ex-spouse. And
that's
that may
right.
not be what you want.
May not be.
Likely not.
Yeah, likely not. Apparently the court decides likely is a good enough assumption. I'm surprised at that. All right, thanks. And we'll have more to come next week on Life and Taxes with Andrew Foster. Going to get in touch with him. Email afoster@harvellandcollins.com and go to harvellandcollins.com for more information.